something is trying to get inside my body.
And you want to sleep with me.
We can't go to camp without our physicals now, can we?
La plume de matante.
I take great relish in savoring each separate horror. I roll them over on my tongue.
Don't, Lord Byron. Don't remind me of it tonight.
Sometimes I have wondered whether life wouldn't be much more amusing if we were all devils.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Yes, I've always dreamed of a little girl just like you.
Welcome to Screaming Queens. This is the pilot episode of our new horror podcast. My name is John Larkin, and I'm joined by Martin Fennessy, Stephen Moore, Jonathan Butler, and when he can be bothered to drag his arse up from London, Stephen Blundell. Screaming Queens sets out to look at the horror genre with a queer eye, taking on ghosts, serial killers, murderers, transvestites, aliens, cannibals, you name it. Each week we'll focus on a different subgenre or film, but here on the pilot we're having some drinks and talking about what made us fall in love with horror in the first place. So, Stephen Moore, do you want to start us off?
Well, the first film I remember really truly scaring me was probably when I watched Arachnophobia. But I wouldn't say that was the first one that really got me into horror film. I just remember being terrified of spiders for the next few months. But I'd say the first film that had a major impact on me was probably Alien, the first time I watched that. I think it's just the complete atmosphere and intense build-up, not necessarily relying on jump scares kind of vibe. It's all about the feeling of what it is and something that you can't see.
All right, Martin, so what got you into horror as a young whippersnapper?
Well, I was a young whippersnapper in the 70s and 80s, so I didn't see a lot of horror as such when I was that age, but probably the first proper horror that I saw was Salem's Lot. That just absolutely terrified me as a film. I just saw it by chance. It happened to be on telly for the first time. My parents were out, watched it. And my bad memory of it was being terrified by what I thought was tapping at the window, but it was actually some girl walking down the street with stilettos on.
I love it. It's such a camp reference. It's a lot as well. Go from vampire children to stilettos.
It was 1983. What can I say?
Okay, Jonathan Butler, what got you into horror in the first place?
Yeah, I think probably The Thing. John Carpenter, The Thing. It's the film that got me interested in horror to begin with. I remember seeing the film as a child, probably when I was about 10 or 12. I just remember the atmosphere of it was so terrifying. The premise of the film is the terror, the horror, could be anybody. And I think that always stuck with me. And I think John Carpenter's films in general are all brilliant.
Okay, what about you, Stephen Blundell? What turned you into this twisted little queen we see before us?
I was obsessed with Hammer horror films. And my dad always used to let me stay up and watch them. My mum wouldn't. So eventually I managed to get a snowy black and white portable in my bedroom, and I used to sneakily watch Hammer horror films in the middle of the night on there. And the other thing that springs to mind is I used to be obsessed with Michael Jackson's Thriller, which really for a child was quite horrific. That used to frighten me, but I had to watch it.
Psycho is something that I always come back to for some reason. I probably saw it when I was in my teens and was just blown away by it, really, because it was, you know, it sort of broke the mould of filmmaking in terms of casting Janet Leigh as the big star, you know, so people who would have seen that the first time back in 1960 or whenever, you went in there expecting to see a big, blonde, gorgeous movie star be the heroine, and then she died halfway through the film. So I just always found that fascinating. I just love the way they do that, and it's a game of two halves where you follow the heroine for the first half, and then the second half you follow the killer. And so that I feel it's such an important film for me, and also for so many filmmakers as well. And you wouldn't have Halloween, would you, without Psycho? So throughout this podcast, you're going to hear the sound of things being poured and ice jiggling about in glasses, because we're all having a little drink to calm our nerves. The podcast is going to cover various things that fascinate us all about horror films. So I thought, as part of the intro, we'd just throw some ideas around, actually, and have you, dear listener, listening in on how we're going to formulate this. So I suppose I wanted to do the podcast because I've heard horror movie podcasts for the last few months. I've been doing my homework, and they've all been really interesting for different reasons, and but you never really hear anything that's coming from the sort of queer angle on horror movies. So what you've got here is four screaming queens who love horror. We've got one token straight boy who knows camp trashy horror as much as anyone does. He's introduced me to a few of them. Savage Streets. Even though it's not horror. Well, it's horrific, but you know. So I thought we'd explore the various things that attracted us to the genre. I think I'd like to talk about a lot of the 80s trashy slasher movies that sort of appealed to a teenage gay boy in the 90s. Things like Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which I know is a really, really, really obvious choice, but classic. It's fun. It's so much fucking fun, isn't it? Sleepaway Camp.
Yes.
We've got to talk about those short shorts and belly tops. Johnny Depp being eaten by his bed in Nightmare on Elm Street, because you would if you were his bed. and the stuff in there that's less obvious. So 80s slashers, I think, is definitely up there for me. Stephen, more?
Say one thing I like to think about with horror is think the mainstream people, like public, when they go to see a horror film, they just kind of want to be scared. I kind of like the idea that horror always managed to get a little message, something subliminal to you, whether it's about politics or queer culture or any kind of message, woman power. For something that's always considered quite misogynistic, there's always a real empowerment of women.
Yeah, I like the idea that there's horror in films that aren't necessarily of the horror genre, and you can find dramas and thrillers that have got plenty of horrible things in them. Mm. And it comes from kind of everyday horror of what people do to each other rather than horror abstracts. And I find those to be more effective, really, because that's something that can affect everyone, not just the characters in films. Mm. So I think I'd like to talk about that at some point. Cool. I'm sure there's plenty of films that people can think of that would fit that description. I have a whole day about Fulci.
Fulci? Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. And if anyone hasn't seen any Fulci, then we can... That's always fun to just sit and watch it. I love watching Fulci films with people who haven't seen them as well. Like, some of the first times I've watched them.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, Lucio Fulci. He's considered by some to be a hack. An exploitative hack who makes complete trash. And he's considered by others to be like a master of horror.
He's considered by himself to be a master of horror, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
I literally would follow on from what Jonathan was saying about the horror within films which aren't necessarily horror films. And the one that springs to mind that really affected me when I was a teenager was Threads.
Yeah.
Which I haven't looked it up, but I was told at the time that supposedly it was considered such a realistic representation of what would happen to society. Has everybody seen it here?
I saw it at the time, on the telly.
Well, I mean, it's frightening, isn't it? Terrifying. It looks a bit dated today, but that gave me nightmares for weeks.
Yeah.
I was about to say, apparently a copy was sent to all of the prime ministers within the EU. So I was told in school, but I haven't looked that up. But presumably because it was so realistic, perhaps we should check that.
Check. You know what? Never let facts get in the way of a good story.
That film horrified me, and it did give me nightmares. And I convinced myself we were about to have nuclear war.
Yeah. Because it was developed as an educational film. That was the point, wasn't it? Wasn't it supposed to go to school?
Wasn't the BBC? It was the BBC.
It wasn't. Just devised as an educational film for schools, but it was much too grave and much too graphic.
Yeah.
But I think it was just at that time the threat of nuclear war was really real, and you can't describe that unless you're living in that time. You did have a sense of that being a realistic prospect in a way that you just can't imagine now, and I think it probably devised by the BBC as just a commentary of what the reality of that would be like at that time, and just how grim and futile the whole thing would be. It would be a hard watch, but it would be a great You
think it's going to end, and you think, oh, it can't get any worse now. Then, like, no, but then 15 years after the nuclear war, this will happen, and it's like, it is just quite relentlessly grim. I'd like to talk about the trans, this sounds really, really wanky, and I don't mean it to, but I don't know the best way to say it, but, like, the representation of trans people in horrors throughout the years, and I don't mean that in a high horse way, because I'm not judging any of them, because they're all of the time, but when you look at things, there's loads of films that I loved growing up, and you'd watch them now and think, my God, there would be a kickoff online. And if this was a film made now, it'd be considered to be
offensive nowadays, but at the time it made complete sense.
Yeah.
And you have to, it's hard watching something back, especially if you never saw it at the time.
Yeah.
Or like when you're younger, to watch something back like that and then go step away from it and think, well,
yeah. Yeah. Films like Silence of the Lambs and Dressed to Kill and things like that, you think, bloody hell, you know, trans people haven't had the best time being represented by horror films over the years.
Isn't that a device there of horror or drama, just to take something that's different and to magnify it or distort it, and particularly in horror to distort it, so it almost magnifies what people's attitudes towards particular things are, whether that's trans people or cannibal films. Yeah, where they're going into the rainforest, and actually that's a really interesting that could be an interesting commentary around race and what people think about.
Yeah,
black people, indigenous people.
Yeah,
it's like when we watched Alien, everyone obviously knows it's a very, very sexual film, like everything in there is phallic and they use lube and condoms as the special effects. It's everything about it is designed to mean sex. And I think it's quite interesting that you impregnate a man and makes a man give birth. I think there's something quite
The concept was apparently in the first place to be like a male rape.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. To make that, when I watched it, it was just like, it's male rape.
Yeah.
And this kind of fear inducing of that, but with an alien twist. And I was like, that's very, very of the time to kind of get one to those kind of years. I don't think that would be the same nowadays.
You wouldn't be able to do that 30 years.
You don't need to hide.
You could do a male rape story and be horrific and just straightforward about that, just as a thing that happened.
Interesting as well, looking at what you two were saying, finding horror in films that aren't necessarily deemed horror. Cruising as well. Have you seen Cruising?
No, I've not seen
William Friedkin film, which actually follows the blueprint of Giallo films as well, doesn't it? It's got the killer with the black gloves on, it's got the knife going in, you don't know who it is right until the end, but it's all set in sex clubs in New York, gay sex clubs in New York in 1980, so, you know, I suppose those things were sort of made, that was vilified when it came out, you know, rightly or wrongly.
It's still not available fully uncut, I don't think, is it, Cruising? I think there's still scenes that have been edited and never ever put back in.
I think they were destroyed.
Or were they just totally destroyed?
I think that's why James Franco made that film, Interior Leather Bar.
Is that what that is?
That's where it's from. Yeah. And
I'm so confused by what that film actually was.
He wanted to recreate the bits of that film, and I think that they were destroyed. That's why he wanted to recreate them. But yeah, they filmed stuff in fisting clubs and stuff that was real sex, and just gone. Not just cut, but destroyed, bitten, stamped on, shot. You know, anything, so people didn't have to see it. That brings our pilot episode to an end. So as the series progresses, we'll be talking more in depth about our favourite horror movies, heroes, villains, subgenres, you name it. But tonight we just thought we'd give you a little taster and get to know everyone. We'd love your feedback, so drop us a line at screamingqueens@gmail.com. That's screamingqueens with a Z @gmail.com, just like Eliza. Next time we're talking all things Hammer Horror. Nothing gets the blood going like a camp count. See you soon.